Please open your Old Testament to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is one of my favorite Old Testament characters. And as I've said a number of times, it almost seems like that my favorite book and my favorite character is the one that I'm studying about at the moment. But I really like to talk about Nehemiah. Nehemiah, lots to be said. In our study, we find that Nehemiah is still in the land of the Medes and the Persians. He's serving as cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And as we look at the first three chapters, we saw that Nehemiah has found out concerning the condition of the land. He's gone before the king, and the king has asked him what he can do to help. And Nehemiah, in essence, tells him, send me so that I can go and do something about the condition of my father's sepulchres. Now, in each step along the way, what did we notice that was unique or peculiar about Nehemiah? What did he do?
He prayed.
Now, these were important decisions that are being made, and he prayed. Let's never underestimate the power of prayer. In the second chapter, they met with opposition as he came to the city, who were among those who opposed his efforts to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. Yes, and we note that he met with opposition from those in the land, and then in the latter part of the second chapter, what did he tell them about their place in the rebuilding of the walls? You don't have anything to do with that. That's our business. It's not yours. In other words, you go home and leave us alone. And when we come then to the third chapter, what was being done? The third chapter. When he came into the city, it was necessary to see what work needed to be done, but then to assign the various tasks to the various families. That's what the third chapter is all about. And then when we come to the fourth chapter, what do the enemies say about their work of rebuilding the walls? All right, it's foolish. You can't do that. If a fox goes upon your stone wall, it will most certainly fall down. And Nehemiah, if you will note, once again prayed in verse 4. Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn back their reproach upon their own head, and give them up for a spoil in a land of captivity, and cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders. So we built the wall, and the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work. Now you'll notice that statement is repeated in verse 15, the last statement. Everyone to his work. They're returning to build walls. In verse 17, they that builded the wall and they that bear burdens laid it themselves, everyone with his hands wrought in the work. And you see that thought again expressed in verse 19 regarding the size of the work and Nehemiah's confidence in God to fight our battles for us. Now, does that sound familiar to you? God will fight our battles for us. You remember the words of Joshua and Caleb as they came back with their report of the land that God had promised to give unto them. Our God will fight for us. Now, we left off at chapter 5. Chapter 5. Now, the thing that has impressed us so far is Nehemiah's leadership, his willingness to take the helm and be the man of action. And we've seen their determination in overcoming their enemies and building the wall. Now it's halfway up. Now in chapter 5, look if you will, beginning at verse 1. Then there arose a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews. For there were that said, we our sons and our daughters are many, let us get grain that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses, let us get grain because of the dearth or drought. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute upon our fields and our vineyards, yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards. Several things going on, but there's one theme that goes through all of that. What is it?
Being cheated by their Jewish brothers. Isn't
that a novel thought? All right, we've got to eat. There's a drought. Don't have any money. What do you do when you don't have any money? You've got to eat.
Borrow
money. All right. The king's taxes are due. You don't have money to pay the taxes. What do some do? Borrow. Now, what were their brethren doing? You said cheat. That's right. Charging them interest. Big interest. Now, what was that doing to them? You know, loans generally have to be secured. What were they securing their loans with?
Their land.
Their children. All right, you borrow against the crop, there's not going to be a crop. You borrow against the land, you borrow against your children. Now, what's that doing to the work? Pardon me? It's more than slowing it down. It's stopping the work. In chapter 5, read in verse 6. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother, and I held a great assembly against them. And I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren, the Jews that were sold unto the nations. And would you even sell your brethren, and should they be sold unto us? What have they done? During this time of restoration, some of the people, of course, had become servants. And you remember when they gathered money from those who desired to stay in the Medo-Persian Empire, and others had been sold out, they take money and they buy them back so they can return if they want to. Now, this is what they did at the beginning of the restoration. What's happened now? It says they held they their peace and found never a word. I like the way that's worded. Anybody ever rebuke you for doing something and you know that they're right? There's just not anything left to say. You know they're right. And when Nehemiah rebukes these people, they didn't have any response because Nehemiah was right. But in the next verse it says, also I said, the thing that ye do is not good. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? Now in verse 12, he said, what you've got to do is you've got to restore what you've wrongfully taken. And they agree, we will restore. Now, tell me who Nehemiah is in an official capacity. He's the governor. That's right. Now, as the governor of King Artaxerxes, Nehemiah is entitled to the governor's wages. In other words, he's getting more money than probably they were. Now, to set a proper example, what did Nehemiah do with the governor's wages? What did he do with the governor's wages? Look at verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year even unto the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. What's that mean? All right, we've not done that. We've been given this, and we've taken nothing. And then in verse 12, but the former governors that were before me were chargeable unto the people, and took of them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people, but so did not I, because of the fear of God. Yea, also I continued in the work of this wall. Neither bought we any land, and all my servants were gathered thither unto the work. Moreover, there were at my table of the Jews and the rulers 150 men, besides those that came unto us from among the nations that were round about us. Question, what did Nehemiah do with the governor's wages or with what he could have received? He fed the people. That's right. He didn't take it. He fed the people. Now, why is that so important in contrast to what they were doing? What attitude is Nehemiah showing toward the people that are in need?
Generosity.
What attitude are they showing toward each other who are in need?
Greed.
Now, Nehemiah rebukes them sharply. In verse 18 it says, "Now that which was prepared for one day was one ox and six choice sheep, also fowls were prepared for me, and once in 10 days stores of all sorts of wine. Yet for all this I demanded not the bread of the governor, because the bondage was heavy upon this people. Remember unto me, O my God, for good all that I have done for this people." I want to call that to your attention. Remember me for good. Now, unity is important. What was happening when they were building on the wall and everybody was working and they were protecting each other with their swords, and they had agreed that wherever Nehemiah had the trumpet blown, they would all gather together there. When unity was occurring, what was happening to the wall? It was getting built. Now that they're taxing each other and taking each other's children and all the high interest and so forth, what's happened to the work? All right? And what does Nehemiah show them? He shows them that what you're doing is sinful. Yes?
All the people who were working on the wall, I'm trying to connect the dots, they weren't able to till their fields.
Either, true.
Right? So they were depending on the others to for something that it would seem to me.
Well, that's perhaps true. We're not really told all the details about how their food was provided, but it was provided. And Nehemiah played a part in that. In the fourth chapter, dropping down into the text. I don't know that we're told.
I was just trying to picture it, you know, when he gives the work assignments in chapter 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Working on the wall.
I don't know if we're told about how that the logistics of all that played out. Certainly a group of people that big had to be fed that they couldn't work. But how that was provided for, I don't know. We do know that during these days of the famine, Nehemiah provided for them and helped them and demonstrated an example how they should be toward each other. Now, the lesson that I want us to take home on this part is that internal strife will cause any work to cease. It doesn't matter much what the work is. If you can't get along, it'll destroy it. When we begin to talk about a local church and its work, what happens if error begins to be taught, our attitudes toward each other begin to become adverse, the work will stop. You can't work if you're fighting. You just can't do it. You can't work if you're fighting with each other. And that's what's taking place here in the 5th chapter. In Ephesians chapter 4 in the New Testament, the church in Ephesus, though it was predominantly Gentile, we want to be reminded that it was made up of Jews and Gentiles. In Ephesians chapter 4, however, beginning in verse 1, the writer said, "I therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, beseech you to walk worthily of the calling wherewith you were called, with all lowliness and meekness, with long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, giving diligence to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Let's pause just there. In Ephesians chapter 4, in verse 3, note that that was everybody's job, to give diligence to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Let us also underscore in our mind that when he said keep the unity of the Spirit, he's not saying just agree or disagree. The unity of the Spirit was the unity that the Spirit had revealed. And that wasn't just, we'll get along no matter what. And then you notice that expression, in the bond of peace. The bond of peace. They've been tied together. Now, we see just a hint here about fellowship. These Jews and Gentiles who had fellowship with God, what did they have with each other? Fellowship with each other. Now, back over in the second chapter, we learned that through the blood of Christ, they had peace with God. And so, consequently, they were to have peace with each other. Fellowship one with another. Now, if you don't have that, you're going to have division. Now, when the Apostle Paul wrote to those in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10, and he commanded them, let there be no divisions among you, but speak the same thing, be of the same mind, of the same judgment. And then he said, I hear that divisions exist among you, and I hardly believe it. What's happened? Pardon me? The unity's gone, that's right. But one said, I'm after Peter, I'm following Apollos over here, and I'm following Paul. And so here we go, we're divided. Now that division in the first chapter of the book, 1 Corinthians, is manifest in almost every chapter. They call in question the apostleship of the apostles and the inspiration of the things that they were revealing. We know that Paul accused them of being carnal-minded in the third chapter. And you can read that all the way through the end of the book. They're divided almost on every front. And what do you suppose happened to the work in Corinth? Well, look at the Galatian letter. We've got a similar circumstance to what we have in the Ephesian letter. We've got division that exists because of the relationship between Jews and Gentiles. In the Galatian letter, there were Jewish teachers that were binding upon the Gentiles portions of the law, in particular circumcision. And, of course, the Gentiles would be resentful of that. They've never been under the law of Moses, never been required to circumcise their children. But to teach that, what would it do to the churches of Galatia? Some binding this, some resisting it. You see the clash? In Galatians, the 5th chapter, and in verse 15, he said, but if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. Now, what's the answer to that? What's the solution that he offers them there? Back up one verse. What's it say? Galatians chapter 5, verse 14. Jenny?
For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself.
All right, were they doing that? No, they weren't doing that. When they were binding something that God had not bound, creating strife and division in the body of Christ. Now, the statement that David made in Psalms 133, verse 1, been quoted so many times, behold, how good or how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. What a wonderful thing. Brethren are getting along based on the truth of God's Word. Now, that doesn't mean we, again, I want to reiterate, that doesn't mean we just agree to disagree. You teach what you want to, and I'll teach what I want to, and we'll all just shake hands and it'll be fine. No, that's not the unity of the Spirit. Now, we talked about the difference between union and unity before, haven't we? You remember the illustration my mother used to give? Taking two cats, tying their tails together, and throw them over the clothesline. You've got union, but you sure don't have unity. Brethren can't just agree to disagree and call that unity. That's not Bible unity. The very word fellowship, and that's a word perhaps we need to talk about. We'll not belabor that point in this class, but the word fellowship simply means partnership, sharing. Participation with. It's really, as you know, disturbing to me that every time sometimes we hear the word fellowship, we think of coffee and donuts. And that's just not so. It's not how the word's used in the Bible. It's used to talk about a sharing that we have in Christ. Now, whether one has a Gentile background or a Jewish background, certainly we observe that the Jews and the Gentiles had different practices and different customs, but in Christ, they were to be one. They were to be one. Now, if you don't have that, you've got a lack of harmony. Randy, comment or question? All right, look, if you will, in your Bible at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and verse 12. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12. Paul said, but we beseech you, brethren, to know them that labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and to esteem them exceeding highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves. I find it interesting in this context of his discussion that he's talking about the relationship of a congregation to elders, I believe. But when he makes the comments regarding the responsibilities and relationship between the elders and the congregation, what is it that becomes the focal point? If you want to help the elders do their job, what do you do to help?
Be at peace among yourselves.
Isn't that a novel thought? Be at peace among yourselves, as Paul said in Ephesians chapter 4 and in verse 3. Strife, internal strife. Out of the efforts of Sanballat and Tobiah and those guys, they could not do what they did to themselves by practicing this high rate of interest in selling their sons and daughters and so forth to pay it. Now, they indicate that we're going to do something about that. We're going to straighten that up and make that right. We promise that we're going to fix that in verse 12. And then we've seen the example of Nehemiah. Let's move on just a little bit. Also, we notice in the sixth chapter, the first effort to get Nehemiah to compromise. I find this fascinating as well. In chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass, when it was reported to Sanballat and Tobiah and to Geshem the Arabian, and unto the rest of our enemies, that I had builded the wall, and that there was no breach left therein, though even unto that time I had not set up the doors in the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come, or cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Then sent Sanballat, his servant, unto me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, It is reported among the nations, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou art building the wall, and thou wouldest be their king, according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, There is a king in Judah. And now it shall be reported unto the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, let us take counsel together. Then I will send unto him, saying, There are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. For they all would have made us afraid, saying, Their hands shall be weakened from the work, but that it be not done so, or that it be not done so. But now, O God, strengthen thou my hands." The report is, we want you to come down, meet with us. Alright, won't do it. Come down and meet with us. No, won't do it. Four times, won't do it. Fifth time, got this letter. You're a bunch of rebels. And Nehemiah, you're trying to be a self-appointed king. And you're sending people throughout the land saying there's a king in Judah, and you're a self-appointed king. If you don't come down and meet with us, we're going to report that to the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. Oh, now he's in trouble. Who do they think sent him down there? You see, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire sent him down there. But what does that amount to? That's just a threat. To get him to compromise. You've heard the expression that when the cat's away, the mice will play. Nehemiah knows that. We're going to revisit that expression just a little bit later when we get over to about the 13th chapter. But they know that. If we can get the leadership away, then what's bound to happen to the work? It'll stop. Now, question. How many congregations do you know of, personally, that were at one time flourishing, had a great eldership, things were going really well? And through the passing of years, what happens to the eldership? Sometimes those same old men, they get old and they die. And what happens sometimes to the local congregation? That's right. Not there anymore. Stops. Lack of leadership. Now, if we can get rid of Nehemiah, we'll stop the work. Now, Nehemiah was smart enough to know that. They're trying to get me away from the work, and I won't do it. Now, look at verse 10. Verse 10. Second effort to get Nehemiah to compromise. And I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of... Say that for me, if you would, Richard, please.
Mehetabel,
thank you. I was putting emphasis on the wrong syllable. It says, who was shut up, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God, wherein the temple, or within the temple. And let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night they will come to slay thee. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being such as I, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And I discerned, and lo, God had not sent him. But he pronounced this prophecy against me. And Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this cause was he hired, that I should be afraid and do so and sin, that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Now, this fellow, Shemaiah, he's going to be real important to us in our studies just a little bit later, but what's he trying to do here? First of all, let me ask, who is he?
He appears to be a prophet, what he says later on.
All right, he appears to be a prophet. He's kind of an important fellow. And he's made a deal with the enemies to bring Nehemiah and house him in the temple. Now, if that happens, what's going to happen to the work? Where does the leader need to be? He needs to be leading. And when Nehemiah said, can such a man as I do that? I can't do that. If I do that, then certainly the building of the temple, the walls, will cease. Now, look further in the text. In verse 14, he said, remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these, their works, and also their prophetess, Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear. Verse 15. So the wall was finished in the 20th and 5th day of the month Elul in 52 days. Why were they so successful in building the wall in such a short time? They had a mind to work. They had a mind to work. And so they finished it in 52 days. Well, I want to drop down to the 7th chapter. The 7th chapter. In chapter 7, now that the walls are built around the city of Jerusalem, we need to determine who's going to live in the city and who's going to perform what function in the city. And how do you do that? You know those books that are so important? The books of the genealogy. That's right. The books of the genealogy. Now let me hasten to say why that was so important. The books of the genealogy, that determined who was who, whether or not you were from the lineage of Judah, whether or not you were from the lineage of Aaron or Levi to be able to serve as a priest. These books of genealogy were crucial. Now, when someone today talks about a restoration of Israel to the land of Canaan, in order for there to be a literal restoration, you have to have the books of genealogy. Now, what we're reading about during the days of Nehemiah was a restoration. They were restored according to the books of genealogy. Temple worship was restored according to the books of genealogy. We've got the right people doing the right things at the right place because they had the books. Now, where are the books today? They're destroyed. No Jew on earth today knows what tribe he's from. So to argue about a future restoration is just ludicrous. No Jew today has any means of knowing what tribe he's from. Not just a matter of ignorance, he don't know. He has not the means to know. Because the books of genealogy, as you know, were destroyed in 70 AD when Titus the Roman general destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Now how do they determine then who's going to live in the city? According to the genealogies. When we come now to the 8th chapter, we're going to skip ahead just a little. When we come down to the 8th chapter, we've got all these people in the land. And we've got the genealogies read, so everybody knows who they are. What else do they need to know? The law of God. Got to know the law of God. Now you remember back over in Deuteronomy chapter 7, where the law of God was to be read in their hearing in a public forum every 7 years. But in a private setting, the law of God was to be taught to their families, to their children, when they get up and go to bed, when they go out and come in. You remember that text from Deuteronomy chapter 6. But during this time of captivity, it appears that their knowledge of the law of God has waned. It's not what it once was. And so they have to be educated. Now, one of the very first things that you want to do when you're trying to educate somebody about a particular law would be what? Read it. So they have a great sentence. And they read the law. And the text tells us that when the book of the law was opened, I like the way that that's presented, the reverend, respectful way, when the book of the law was opened by Ezra on the pulpit of wood, the people stood up. And they stood up from early morning to midday while Ezra read. Now somebody says, well, I don't like to listen to somebody read. I don't like to listen to somebody read that doesn't read well. I don't know how well Ezra read, but they heard what he said. And they listened reverently to what he had to say. And they listened for a long time. I was talking to someone yesterday or today about this very fact. How that friend of mine, well, you know, Lowell Blackman and Albert Dabbs in Arkansas used to go to Nigeria quite a little bit. And many of the Nigerian preachers would walk, sometimes walk all day or further, and spend a considerable amount of time for the Blackman and the Dabbs were teaching classes. And they would sit on a board that was propped up on concrete blocks. And they had several of those. You know, we think these padded pews are really nice. They just had several makeshift pews out of boards and concrete blocks. They didn't have a back to lean against. They just sat on the boards. And Lowell told me many, many times that they would start early in the morning. They would take a break or two during the day. And he said, you just have to tell them late at night, we've got to quit. It's time to go to bed. They'd sit there and listen. They wanted to know, just like a sponge to drink it up. They were asking questions. They wanted to know. I was commenting to someone about this relative to gospel meetings. We have padded pews, air conditioning, heating in the wintertime. We've got everything real nice. We don't have to walk to get to the building. We can ride in a comfortable automobile. And sometimes we get uncomfortable if the preacher goes past the hour. Now, there's something just wrong about that. There's just something that's wrong about that. There's an attitude that existed with these people to absorb what was being said, to understand the importance of it. You see, they weren't there just out of force of habit. They were there to hear the law of God. And I think sometimes we just simply miss that. Now, when the law of God was read in their hearing, you'll note in verse 7, a host of people, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce all their names, but what did they do? They explained it. They explained the law. Here you have men who are qualified men who know the law, and once it has been read, they're explaining the law to the people. And then in verse 8 it says, and they read in the book in the law of God distinctly, and they gave the sense so that they understood the reading. Someone was talking with me recently, I don't remember who it was, about reading the law of God. Maybe over at Las Vegas, where Brother Lewis is preaching, Lewis Wells. You haven't met Lewis Wells yet. I anticipate that you will. He's their preacher. And he was injured back many years ago, and he's blind. And he can quote a lot of Scripture. But he has a reader.
And if he doesn't quote it, he'll call on one of the fellows to read it for him. Now, the reading of the scriptures needs to be done with reverence, distinctly. And what I want you to see here is we can read it. We can read it distinctly. We can learn what it says. Here are people who hadn't heard the law in a long time. And when they hear it read, what do they learn? Chapter 8.
Pardon me?
That they've not kept it.
They've not kept it. What effect does it have on them?
They wept.
Can you imagine reading the scriptures and say, this applies to me. I've not done this. I've got to fix this. It breaks their heart that what they've done has been displeasing to God. Now, what have they done? Chapter 9. Well, they confess their sins, yes, but what sins do they confess? What have they done? They disobeyed God, yes, what? They married foreign wives. Now keep in mind, it's been more than just 70 years since some of these people have left the land. Certainly we know from the time of the captivity of Jerusalem, the fall of Jerusalem, till the first of the exiles returned, 70 years, that's true. But what about those who've been captive by the Assyrians that the Babylonians have now when they conquered the Assyrians, you see? And what about those who perhaps have been born in this 70-year period? You know, we're not talking about babies anymore. And they've not heard the law of God. What have they done? They've lived like everybody else lived. Now, don't we do that? Often because we don't know any better. We just live like everybody else lives. And what they did was they married just anybody that they wanted to marry. But God had placed some restrictions upon the marriage of these Jews. Who were they to marry? Jews. And you can read that in Deuteronomy chapter 7. They were not to intermarry with the heathen nations round about them. But even though we might reason and say, well, they were in captivity and didn't know any better, did that excuse them? No. I want us to look carefully at this portion of the text in chapter 9. Chapter 9. They confess their sins. That's right. And there are numerous sins that they confess. If you drop down further in the chapter, you'll see that they rebelled. And this is a part of their confession as well. Verse 30, yet many years didst thou bear with them and testified against them by thy spirit through the prophets, yet would they not give ear. Therefore gavest thou them into the hand of the peoples of the land. Nevertheless, in thy manifold mercies thou didst not make a full end of them nor forsake them, for thou art a gracious and merciful God. Nehemiah is very plain. Here's what we did. Now, in this process, we've got to fix this when we come to the 10th chapter. Nehemiah, the 10th chapter, beginning in verse 9, after the law has been read, in verse 29, of chapter 10, it says, they clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and unto an oath to walk in God's law, which he giveth by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe to do all the commandments of Jehovah our God, and his ordinances and his statutes, and that we would not give our daughters unto the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath a day to sell, that we would not buy of them on the Sabbath, nor on a holy day, and that we would forego the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Well, let's go back and see what that means in terms of application. They said, we are not to give our daughters to their sons. But, you know, we've already done that. And we're not to take or give our, flip that thing around, sons to their daughters. How do we fix that? Go back to Ezra chapter 9. Ezra chapter 9 and chapter 10. You see the same thing in these chapters that you see in Nehemiah chapters 9 and 10. There is confession of sin. We see that Ezra's reaction, we'll talk about that when we get to the 13th chapter of Nehemiah in greater detail, but he's just terribly upset by what these people have done. And when you come to the 10th chapter, it says in the latter part of verse 2, "We have trespassed against our God and have married foreign women of the peoples of the land, yet now there is hope for Israel concerning this thing." Look at what we've done. But there's hope. What do we have to do about it? Verse 3, "Now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away all such wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law." Not supposed to have been married with these people, but we did. How do we make it right? Have to put them away. Now, brethren, give me a moment on this. When you look in the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 14 and Mark chapter 6, you read about a man whose name was Herod. Herod had married Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. Now, what did John say was wrong about that? He said it's unlawful for you to have her. Well, would it have been wrong if he had had somebody else's wife? Yes. You know, I talk with people about that, and they say, well, you know, the law of Moses says that a man was not to live in incest. He couldn't take his brother's wife. Would it have been all right if he'd taken somebody else's wife? No, that wouldn't have been all right either. Furthermore, was Herod a Jew? No, he was not a Jew. What makes us think then that Herod was under the law of Moses relative to the marriage relationship to begin with? He wasn't under that law. He was not a Jew. Oh, he knew the law, and he knew the Jews and their customs and practices very well. But he was not a Jew. Now, what we want to see in that is the argument that says, oh, well, Matthew 14 and Mark chapter 6, that had to do with the law and incest between Herod and Herodias. You might want to do some research on that and see if Herodias was still married to Philip. If memory serves me correctly, I believe a divorce had taken place and Herod had married her. But you see the problem with that. John lost his head because he said, yeah, that's not lawful. That's not right. Now, what are you going to do to make it right? You're going to have to stop having her. Now, that's just the way it is. And that's what took place during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. They stopped having these foreign women. They had to put them away. Now, what effect did that have on Ezra? Go back to Ezra chapter 10. Understanding what had to be done. It says in verse 6, "Then Ezra rose up from before the house of God and went into the chamber of Jehonabad, the son of Elisha. And when he came thither, he did eat no bread nor drink water, for he mourned because of the trespass of them of the captivity." What have they done? They've intermarried with these heathen nations. What's the answer? We're going to have to fix this. Well, we'll just say, I'm sorry, and keep it. We won't do it anymore, but we'll keep it. We've got to fix this. What effect did it have on Ezra? It just tore him up. Now, sometimes we think that a preacher preaching these kind of things, that we get some kind of sadistic glee out of telling somebody that what you're doing is sinful. No, sir. I've often told audiences that I would preach these things to. You want to cry about it, I'll cry with you. I've done it. Sat down and cry with you. Now, question. Because we just hate it, both of us does that mean then that the solution is somehow different? Now, here's another thought I want to throw at you. Somebody says, well, that was because they had intermarried the heathen nations. That has nothing to do with committing adultery. They weren't even accused of committing adultery. Don't miss the point. What they did was unlawful. God had legislated the marriage relationship, and they had not abided by it. Has God legislated the marriage relationship for you? Has He legislated the marriage relationship for those who are not Christians? Has He? Yes. Now, question. When I have no respect for that which God has legislated, whether it be under the law of Moses or whether it be under the law of Christ in the New Testament, the wife that I have taken, is she no less unlawful? Granted, these wives were not unlawful because it was adultery, but it was still unlawful. Now, when you commit adultery, like Herod did, John said it's not lawful for you to have her. Well, it wasn't because she was a heathen nation. Herod wasn't a Jew. He could marry whoever he wanted to. Well, what was the problem then? She was married to somebody else. Herod's guilty of adultery. And we say, well, a divorce occurred. Oh, that fixes it, don't it? No, that does not fix it. The divorce, unlawful. Subsequent marriage, unlawful. Constitutes adultery. Now, how do we fix it?
Undo it.
We've got to undo it. Now, if I missed that somewhere, somebody help me with that. I had a gentleman want to help me with that over at Las Vegas. He didn't help me much. Now, the point I'm trying to make, in all sincerity, is it'd be a lot easier for me to believe what that fellow was trying to teach me. Now, you know what he was trying to teach? Just a minute. I'm going to take advantage of it. He was trying to teach that if you're divorced because you're guilty of fornication, then the one who's innocent can put you away and they can remarry without sin. So in reality, if you've committed adultery, you've been put away, your mate can remarry, which means that you don't have a companion anymore. You don't have a husband or a wife. You're a single man. Now what then can you do? Well, let every man marry to avoid fornication. Now, whether I'm guilty of fornication or not really becomes a moot point, doesn't it? Because his argument is, if one free, both free, and it really doesn't make much difference regarding cause. Now, let me ask you a question, brethren. If I decide one day that I just don't like Donna anymore, I'm going to divorce her because I want another one. Two things I can do. One, I can just divorce her for no cause. This gentleman would say, well, you've committed sin. But all I have to do to fix that, say, well, I'm sorry, I wouldn't do it again. I had my time to go over. But now that I have, I can go out and get another one. He also affirmed that if I want to get rid of her, then I can commit fornication. He said, she can put me away for the cause of fornication. But then I don't have a wife. She put me away. So, let every man marry so he can avoid fornication. Do we not see that that puts a premium on sin? If I don't want her, what do I do? Get rid of her and get another one. And just say, well, I wouldn't do it again. I asked that gentleman. I said, suppose I do that once. And I decide I'm going to keep this one. But then I find some traits in her that I really don't like either. And here's another gal over here at work that I think she's just, man, she's the apple of my eye. So I'm going to get rid of wife number two, and I'm going to have wife number three. Just how many times can I do that in a lifetime? How many wives can I have? 25 or 30? He said, yes. Yes, have it all you want. I was going to ask you, how is that really any different from the standard that the world lives by? That is the standard that the world lives by. Oh, well, we'll get back to this. Try to get back on track Sunday morning. Oh, by the way, if you do not have lesson number 35, Jerusalem is rebuilt, the questions, they're up here on the table. You're going to need those. Okay? Lesson number 35, Jerusalem is rebuilt.